Do you have anyone close to you who does not believe what you believe about Jesus? Maybe you've had conversations with this person, and you've explained to them why you find yourself believing, every reason that you can think of as to why you believe in Jesus Christ, and you plead with them, and you communicate as honestly and earnestly as you can, and you're met with cold, blank, uninterested gazes. Maybe you're not just met with a gaze. Maybe you're met with a response. Maybe the response is something like, well, religion in general, and Christianity in particular, is old-fashioned, outdated. We don't need it anymore. Why do we need it? We have technology, we have science, we have education. Maybe they wouldn't say we don't need it, but maybe they would say it's just not true. A person can't believe that this is true. Maybe the person wouldn't say something quite as strong as that, but might say something like, I respect you and your beliefs, but Christianity just isn't for me. Maybe they would echo the popular postmodern sentiment, well, Christianity is true for you, but it's not true for me. It works for you, but it doesn't work for me. And they hope that you can just leave it at that. We're accustomed to expect these sorts of responses from people who don't have similar backgrounds to us. Many of you were brought up in the church. Many of you were brought up with strong Christian influences. We can make it harder for ourselves, though. I'm sure some of you know someone who, like you, grew up in a Christian home, like you, attended church regularly, like you, heard the gospel, and today they would say they don't believe that anymore. I believed that when I was younger, but I'm different today. Things have changed. I can't believe what I used to believe. I'm sure all of us know someone who's taken a path like that. We can make it even harder, though, for ourselves. Recently, there have been a few prominent people who have defected from the faith. These people taught for years in the church and had an influence not just in their local bodies, but in America broadly, through their books, through their songs. How do we explain this? How can someone devote most of their adult life to the gospel and then say, I don't believe that anymore? How do we explain that, and how do we explain the more mild case of someone who thinks that Christianity just isn't for them? Well, we have an answer in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and it's an answer that we probably won't like, and that our culture certainly won't like, but that nonetheless is here in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I want to answer the question from this text, not only why is there unbelief, why do so many people not believe in Jesus, but also why does anyone at all believe in Jesus? We have those two questions raised and answered by today's text. So first, we should deal with the question, why is there unbelief? As to why there's unbelief, again, not a happy answer or one that's easy for us to tolerate. But 2 Corinthians chapter 4 basically says that the reason there are people who don't believe in Jesus today is because they have been blinded by the devil. Ultimately, people do not believe in Jesus because they are blind. Now, we have in chapter 4 of 2 Corinthians, verse 4, in their case, that is, the unbelievers, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Now, leading up to this very impactful statement in verse 4 is Paul's explanation of how he and his fellow ministers have attempted to conduct themselves as preachers of the gospel message they've been commissioned to preach. Verse 1, therefore, having this ministry, verse 1 through 3, I should say. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. Paul wants the Corinthians and us to know that he did not preach in a manipulative way. He did not find people coming to Christ because he was so clever. He was able to persuade them by his wisdom. Paul wants us to know that people did not believe and people believed because of some deeper reason other than his preaching of the gospel. So Paul was traveling throughout the Mediterranean and preaching in this town and this town and this town, and in places he was met with people who received the message and believed. They heard Paul preach by the open statement of the truth. They heard him speak plainly the gospel, and they believed. The implication here is that Paul is preaching plainly, clearly, basically, and that there are people who receive the message, and there are people who refuse, reject, and revile the message. The same message. People don't start following Christ and start listening to Paul more because they've been duped, in other words, or because they've been taught some sort of message that appeals to them. You see here, God's word. We do not tamper with God's word. The message hasn't been watered down. Often people will believe a certain message that is presented to them as Christianity, genuine Christianity, but if you really examine it, it's a watered-down version. People will believe all sorts of things if they think there's something in return for them, or if maybe it's not as hard as it seems to be. But Paul wants us to know that he taught the undiluted gospel that he was commissioned to preach. This was his modus operandi as a preacher, to speak plainly and clearly so that everyone can understand the message. We have him make similar statements elsewhere. So, for example, in chapter 1 of 2 Corinthians, verses 12 through 13 of chapter 1 in 2 Corinthians, he says this, "For our boast is this, our boast as ministers, the testimony of our conscience, that we behaved in the world with simplicity and godly sincerity, not by earthly wisdom, but by the grace of God, and supremely toward you. For we are not writing to you anything other than what you read and acknowledge." In the NIV, it says, "For we did not write to you using worldly wisdom. We did not write to you anything that you cannot understand." Paul and his fellow ministers preached the gospel, and they preached it clearly. And they were met by people who believed it, and they were met by people who rejected it. And the people who believed it did not believe it because Paul manipulated them. They heard the message, and they believed it. So what message did they hear? Well, they would have basically heard this, that man is fallen and sinful, sinful beyond what they like to think of themselves, that Christ, the very Son of God, came into this world, died on the cross as a payment for their sins, and rose from the dead 3 days later. That's the basic gospel message, if we were to simplify it in that manner. So they hear that, and they don't believe it. Verse 3 of chapter 4. "Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing." And then we have, "In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers." So there were people 2,000 years ago, and there are people throughout history, and there are people today who Paul says cannot see. There's a veil covering the message when it's heard, when it's preached. This veil is opaque. They hear the words, they understand the sentences, they understand the message, but they don't see what they're supposed to see. We have more extreme examples of people not seeing what they're supposed to see. For example, Jesus' executioners. In 1 Corinthians 2, verse 8, we have this astonishing statement. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. So people saw Jesus and they wanted to kill him. They saw him and they saw a rebel. They saw a usurper of their authority. They saw someone who was disruptive and someone who needed to be ended. And that's all they saw. That's the extent of what they saw. The veil covered Jesus, covered his true nature as the Lord of glory. And again, we have this veil because we have the blinding work of Satan. It's worth examining this phrase more closely. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. You'll notice in the first part of this statement that Paul does not say, in their case, the God of this world has blinded the eyes of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing. Now, he could have, and you would think that would make more sense. Do you see with the mind? And he's speaking metaphorically anyway, so he might as well have said, in their case, the God of this world has blinded the eyes of unbelievers so they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory. He doesn't say, for the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from thinking through or reasoning to the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. So why does he say the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers? I think all of us will admit that this is a stronger statement than the God of this world has blinded the eyes. What do you use your mind to do? Everything. You cannot do a single thing without using your mind. Now, what is Paul not saying here? Paul is not saying that unbelievers cannot think, or that they're not smart, or that they're not educated, or anything like that. He's saying that in one particular regard, they cannot think truly. They cannot think truly as to the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. It doesn't say that their minds are blinded so that it's hard for them, so that it takes a little more work for them, so that unlike you, who are a natural, it takes them some practice to see. He's saying the minds of the unbelievers have been blinded to keep them from seeing. And the NIV says, so that they cannot see. They cannot see what they're supposed to see. And what are they supposed to see? We have the second half of this statement. They're supposed to see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. That's a lot. Couldn't he have made it simpler? To keep them from seeing the light of Christ, to keep them from seeing the gospel of Christ, to keep them from seeing Christ. He doesn't say this. He says to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. A compounded statement. So what is he getting at here? It's worth taking a brief tangent, and hopefully you'll indulge me. So I want to talk for a minute here about music. Music is something which most people consider to be subjective. So we can't put music in a test tube. We can't weigh music. We can weigh people in bands. But music as an art form is subjective. We like to think of all art as subjective. So you have your tastes, I have mine. So for example, I really like a lot of jazz, and some of you could probably go there with me. But I also like a lot of free jazz. I like a lot of avant-garde jazz. And I'm fairly confident that if I were to play some right now, many of you would leave, probably. And I wouldn't blame you. I understand that some people do not like avant-garde jazz. I totally get it. So we see there's obviously this subjective element to music and our appreciation of it. But we can make this so that the subjective element seems to fade into the background. So for example, there are some pieces of music that are so well appreciated and so universally loved that we don't want to say that it's subjective whether or not you think Handel's Messiah is a good piece of music or any number of Bach's compositions. Or maybe even some of the Beatles songs. Like, who doesn't like Hey Jude? I don't like the Beatles, but that's a good song. So, we can think of music, some of it at least, as being objectively beautiful. What do you say to a person who listens to Handel's Messiah and says, does nothing for me? How would you approach this person? What would you say to them? You could explain to them the theory behind the piece, the music theory. Maybe you know a little bit about music and you show them, look at this, this harmony here is very creative. This rhythm here makes perfect sense as a transition. You could explain all of these different facts about the piece of music. And then the person understands you. You're such an effective communicator that they hear what you're saying and they say, oh, I totally get it now. Let's play it again. Let's listen to it again. And they hear the song again. Do you think this person who found no joy the first listen will now be thrilled now that he knows the theory? I mean, maybe. Some people, maybe. But you can imagine a person hearing and knowing all that he now knows about this song, this piece of music, hearing it again, and saying, it's okay. You can imagine this person. Now, the gospel is obviously not a piece of music. But like some of these pieces of music, the gospel is objectively true. It's also objectively beautiful and objectively glorious. I would feel bad for the person who wouldn't like Handel's Messiah. They can't enjoy the music for what it truly is. So too, Paul says, the unbelievers cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. They can hear the message. You can explain each part in great detail to them. They will not see the light of the gospel of the glory. They won't see it as beautiful. They won't see it as worthwhile. They won't see it as something they should devote their lives to. They will see it as just, it's okay. Or they'll see it as, that's horrible. I don't like that. You'll have any range of responses to it. These few verses in chapter 4 of 2 Corinthians explain the whole range of responses to the gospel. They explain the friend of yours who respects you and says, I just don't believe it. And they explain the hardened atheist who tries to persuade people that belief in God is irrational. They explain the whole range of responses to the gospel. It's worth commenting briefly on the nature of this blinding. We see that the minds of the unbelievers have been blinded. So they cannot think truly and rightly about the gospel so as to see that it is glorious, beautiful, and true. But how does this happen? Does Satan just, you're blind, you're blind, you're blind, you're blind, you're blind? Just random selection of blinding. It's not clear, at least from this passage, how the blinding works. It's worth saying, though, that the Bible seems to say that one of the ways that people are blinded is sin. Romans chapter 1 describes the nature of man in his sin without God. It says that people are presented with a clear revelation of who God is. And Romans 1, it's important to say, is not talking about the gospel. It's talking about a general sense of God. Romans 1 says that basically everyone knows that there's a God. They know some things about him. So they know that he's powerful to create what we see. They know also that he is to be obeyed. And Romans 1 tells us that people respond to that revelation by pushing it away, pushing it to the side. Now, I think that one of the ways that Satan blinds people is through sin. God, it's said in Romans 1, lets people basically sin. He lets them give themselves to that which is not him. And it may be the case that Satan blinds through sin and its deceit. We have other passages about the world lies in the power of the evil one. Well, people are deceived by sin and lies and deceit, which makes sense. So maybe it's through sin. Maybe it's some other way, but there's good biblical evidence that sin plays a part in this blinding. The important thing is that the god of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. So this is a very depressing text, at least through verse 4. So the answer as to why there's unbelief is a simple answer, an unexpected answer, and doubtless an unpopular answer. Satan has blinded the minds of unbelievers. We are in a supernatural text here. So, I told you we were going to be answering two questions. I think the first one has been answered to the extent we can answer it today. The second question is, okay, there's all this blindness. Why does anyone believe at all? I did just say that sin, Satan blinds people through sin. Well, we're all sinners. Why aren't all of us blind? Well, we get that answer in verse 6 of this passage today. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So we have another simple answer as to why there are people who believe. God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts. So Paul is saying here that there was a time at which he was blind. He was blinded by Satan at one point in his life. But then what happens? Satan doesn't decide, "I'm going to let him see now." Satan doesn't say, "Okay." Paul doesn't stop sinning and then he sees. What happens to Paul? Paul's walking along. Well, maybe is he on a horse? He's traveling. And Jesus shows up and he says, "I'm here." And Paul can't see. And he's blinded, ironically. But from this point on, we know Paul believes in Jesus. Paul wasn't not on his way to persecute more Christians when that happened. Paul didn't clean himself up in any particular way. And then Jesus said, "Okay, now he's ready for me to knock him over." Jesus just did it. God just said, "I'm going to do it. I'm going to open his eyes by blinding him, literally." Now, Paul was blind. If you're a Christian today, it's because you were also blind. Nobody is a blank slate. Nobody comes to believe in Jesus as an objective observer of the facts. If you believe in Jesus, it's not ultimately because of anything you did. There are people who can read the same books as you. Let's say you were not convinced that Christianity was true, and so you read a bunch of apologetic books, you read the whole Bible a few times, which often happens with people, and then one day you said, I can't fight this anymore. I believe that this is true. I have to believe this. I believe in Jesus." You can have the same person, sorry, not the same person, that would be crazy. Take any other person similar to you, similar background, similar upbringing. They read the same books. They read the Bible. Is it guaranteed that they're going to believe? No, it's not. I can think of many people who have read the Bible and think, it's just another religious book. You can think of academics who have prodigious grasp of the languages, of the composition of the text, of the time, of the culture, of other religions in existence at that time, who read the New Testament and understand it at a level that you will never be able to understand it, given their grasp of the language and all the above-mentioned subjects. But they'll just think, "Oh, this is a great way of understanding the early Christians." That's all they'll think. That is the extent of what they will see here. So, God has to shine into your heart if you were to believe. This is the only way you can be saved. Now, notice Paul says, "For God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,'" first part. Most commentators agree, and I think it's quite clear that this is referring to the early chapters of Genesis. In Genesis, we have the story of how God made the world. In comparative religions, oftentimes there's a lot of work done to see how God in Genesis does things and how the gods in the ancient pantheon do things. One of the things that people notice is that God in Genesis, unlike many of these other stories, does not rely on anything that already exists to make the world. We get a nice Latin phrase from this Christian doctrine called creation ex nihilo, which means creation out of nothing, which is also another way of saying creation by nothing. God did not use stuff that was existing at the same time as him, coterminous with him. God made everything out of his own power and deity. Now, we get also an attribute of God from this doctrine of Christian teaching, and we get another nice Latin word, aseity. God's divine attribute of aseity is from the Latin preposition a, which means from or by, and se, which means himself, herself, not herself, himself. So, God creates aseity out of his self, by himself. That's how I translate aseity, by himselfness. So God does not rely on anything to create the world. He simply does it of his own volition, of his own power. It's also worth saying that the converse is true. Nothing hinders God from creating the cosmos. There's not an equal but opposite force who he has to overcome before he can create the world. There's not something he has to learn before he can create the world. There is nothing you can imagine that prevents God from creating the world. Why is Paul telling us about Genesis? Well, Paul's basically saying that the creation of the cosmos and the salvation of sinners is on the same par. So, when's the last time you thought about the creation and expansion of the universe and thought of it as basically the same as your conversion? I don't think we do. And there are reasons we don't. Doesn't seem like that big a deal sometimes. Like, I didn't believe, but now I believe. I mean, I believe something different now, but it's not like a universe was created. Why are you saying that? The text basically says that a universe was created, except it doesn't. A new person is created, a new creature, something that was not before, that now is. The same God who said, "Let there be light," and everything, is the God who says, "Let there be light in you, if you believe." Same God who will say, if he chooses, "Let there be light," in the person you know, in the friend. This is obviously radical. Just like God didn't ask us for help when he was creating the universe, because we were not, just like he didn't ask for anyone's help when he was creating the universe, he does not need the sinner's help to save them. We don't like this idea very much at all. We like to give ourselves more credit than we're due, according to the Bible, when it comes to salvation. Now, does a person have to have faith in Christ to be saved? Yes. Is that something you do? Yes and no. Can you tell a person, just believe in Jesus, and then they say, "Oh yeah, I believe in Jesus"? Well, sometimes, but why? Because God is shining his light. Now, what's he shining his light on? It's not just a vague spiritual encounter. It might be. Some people have radical conversion experiences, like Paul. If you haven't been knocked off a horse, don't think you might not be a Christian. Sometimes it is that way. Sometimes you get knocked off a horse, and then, "I'm a Christian." But sometimes it's not. Sometimes you just wake up after studying, after thinking, and you just say, "I believe this now. I find myself believing this." So it's not a spiritual experience, this light shining, in the sense of being something dramatic or overly emotional. It might be, but it's not necessarily. So what is this light that God gives? It's not a fuzzy feeling, necessarily. It's light of a definite content. So here we see, God has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Light of the knowledge. So the light that God shines isn't shining just all over the place. It's just shining. It's just so bright. It's shining in a direction. It's shining towards the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So, God shines in the heart of an unbeliever to give them a revelation of the knowledge of who Jesus really is. So, no longer is he just a prophet from 2,000 years ago. No longer is he just a rebellious political figure. No longer is he just the most influential person who's ever lived. Now he is the very glory of God. And you see in verse 4, let's go back. The minds of the unbelievers have been blinded to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. God is there, and people don't know it. They can't see it. Could you have done anything to make them see it? You wouldn't tell them to ignore him. But what can you do? This passage might make us feel like we're helpless and hopeless. It's not even worth talking to that friend who doesn't believe, that loved one. But you'll notice here that Paul believed all of this. Paul believed that if people are blind, it's because of Satan, and if people see who Jesus is, that he's the very image and glory of God, it's because God did it. So why is he preaching? God can just do that, right? I said that God created the world without asking anybody's help or advice. So why doesn't God just shine into people's hearts? Why don't we just stop? Why don't you just stop talking to your friends? Why don't people stop evangelizing? Well, why didn't Paul stop evangelizing? The chief apostle knew all of this, that if a person who is blind is going to see again, he needs God. And there's no hope if God doesn't shine. Paul's not God. Paul can't shine the light of God. So why didn't he stop preaching? Well, you'll notice that, again, the light shines on a content-full message and person. God doesn't shine generically because he wants people to know who Jesus is and what he did. God has ordained that people will see and know those things through, as Paul says, the foolishness of what we preach. So Paul didn't stop preaching because he didn't want to disobey God. And Paul didn't stop preaching because he knew that God decided, I'm going to save people by lowly nobodies saying some things. Jesus died, he rose again for your sins, he's coming back. And then people would believe because I would shine through that. So do not lose heart here. The same God who says, yes, if somebody's going to be saved, it's totally up to me. I shine my light on the face of Jesus Christ so that people can know, is the same God who said, preach, tell them about Jesus, because through the message, God shines his light. So don't give up on your friend, your family member. Don't give up on anyone. Because the same God that created the world is the same God who saves sinners.